Yeah, this is...
I think we should start smaller. We should probably for Pacific Core this time.
All right, thanks.
All right,
I'm good. Welcome back. Happy holidays to you.
And you.
We've got your back.
Council will come back to order. And I guess we'll get you to call the roll a little later.
Roll call. Novick?
Call the roll now.
Here.
Fritz.
Here.
Fish.
Here.
Saltzman. Nails.
Here. Okay, we're going to take an item out of order because Mr. Schaff has to get back to another meeting. So with the council's agreement, we'll take 1208 briefly from the regular calendar and turn it over to Commissioner Fish and David Schaff.
Item 1208, amend contract with MWH Americas, Inc., to extend term and increase compensation in the amount of $1,475,000 for the Kelly Butte Reservoir Project.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you for your courtesy. David's leading a BAC meeting this afternoon, and I want him to be there because the Water Bureau BAC is doing the hard work of helping us get the rates right. So this is the introduction. This contract adjustment that is before us does not affect the overall budget for the project. During the construction phase of this project, contaminated soils and other materials were found, which required design modifications and significant additional work from the Bureau's engineer of record, MWH Americas. The Bureau is still well within the current budget estimate, which is actually lower than the amount originally approved by Council. We have David Schaff here today to answer any questions that you or my colleagues may have.
Do you think you're done with contract modifications at this point, David?
This is for the design. Hope so.
Yeah.
It should be, but we're in the middle of the construction now, and we should be well along finishing the project. The project itself will finish about this time next year. The reservoir should be in operation.
Other questions for David? Okay. Thank you very much. So anyone wants to testify on this item?
We had Shedrick Wilkins signed up earlier. Joe, did you want to speak?
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Joe wants to
come
speak.
Come on up.
Mr. Walsh.
Joe Walsh, Individuals for Justice. Just for the record, I think this is terrible. You know our position on covering the reservoirs, and this contract should not go forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joe. As somebody who used to be in construction, you know that sometimes jobs change as you build them. That's what's happening here.
Is this an emergency?
This is not an emergency item.
No, it's not.
Right? So this passes to second reading.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. Okay, now let's return to the regular agenda as left behind from this morning.
Item 1205, accept and appropriate a grant in the amount of $131,645 from the State of Oregon, Oregon Military Department, Office of Emergency Management, Fiscal Year 2013, State Homeland Security Grant Program to fund joint state bomb teams, equipment, and training.
Okay, do we have a presentation on this? We have some folks available. There's a bomb squad call out this morning, so maybe everybody was at that. Afternoon, how are you?
Good afternoon. Pat Walsh from the Tactical Operation Division. I'm the captain there. And this grant is more of a statewide. This is our portion of a statewide grant, and it will pay for an upgrade to one of our robots. It's 5 years old, and then purchase a sensor that the bomb team uses to detect bombs, and also pay for training. We have not been as diligent as we would like to be because of the cost of training, and we want to make sure that all of our bomb techs, not just in the metro area, but in the entire state, are nationally and internationally certified, because this arena has changed drastically in the last 10 years with the war, so they need to keep up on their training.
Questions from Walsh? Thank you very much. Anyone else wants to testify on this item?
No one else signed up.
I just have a question. How many bombs have gone up in Portland in the last 10 years? And
All right, I can partially address that. Any other comments or questions? This is an emergency ordinance, so let's take a roll call.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Hales?
I don't think there have been many bombs that have gone off, but there was actually a bomb squad call out to a local hotel this morning, a bomb scare. I think the fact that we've heard nothing further means that it was just a bomb scare. And ironically, while we were debating and discussing police use of force, the chief has been called away to a use of force incident that was one of our police officers being required to ram a fleeing homicide suspect's vehicle. So ironies abound. Occasionally, you need a bomb squad. Aye. Okay, 1206, please.
Authorize the submittal of a boundary change request to the state of Oregon to add 172.5 acres to the Portland Enterprise Zone.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon. Mayor, commissioners, thank you for your time and having us come down today. My name is Andy Reed. I administer the Enterprise Zone on behalf of the Portland Development Commission and the City of Portland. And with me is Josh Thomas from the Port of Portland. So we're going to go through the action that we're going to be requesting and also discuss some kind of an overview of what the Enterprise Zone is and some of the benefits we've seen recently through the program. So to start, we've had an Enterprise Zone in Portland since 1986. We are one of 60-plus jurisdictions that have E-zones across the state of Oregon. We actually have two. Last year, you approved a second Enterprise Zone for East Portland, which I will discuss in a couple of minutes. In essence, it's a five-year tax abatement for companies that are making new investment in capital improvements, machinery, equipment. Land and existing investments do not receive the tax exemption. So again, it's for the new investment that's coming online. When companies enroll in the program with us, they're required to increase employment by 10% and also provide other community benefits. Some of these include paying 150% of minimum wage, that's $13.50 an hour. Our E-Zone companies across the board pay more than $20 an hour in wages with an additional $9 an hour in benefits. And we have them report that to us every single year, so we have some pretty good data on what our companies are doing with our citizens, our residents who are gaining employment with them.
Can you remind us how you enforce that? So, for example, in our city's tax abatement program, we monitor tax abatements every year, and if someone falls out of compliance, we terminate the abatement prospectively. What's your enforcement mechanism here?
Yeah, so the state of Oregon, Multnomah County, and PDC all work together to monitor. If they catch wind of something at the state or the county, they'll let me know, and vice versa if I catch wind of something that's going awry. And typically the companies will tell us, or we'll see in the news, that there's been a layoff of some sort. And so they actually have a one-year in-lieu payment where they can make a payback of 1 year of taxes if they drop below the employment threshold. If they do that 2 years in a row, then it's a full disqualification. And so there is a mechanism in place, and we've been monitoring it very closely. So they report to us two times a year, so we get pretty good data throughout the year. So other benefits that the companies have to maintain, they have to have employees. The increase in 10%, they have to maintain those employees for the life of the tax abatement. And to your question again, if they don't maintain those, that kind of that upper, higher level of employment, that will negatively affect their tax abatement. And last, companies are required to come up with a plan to do local procurement. In 2011, one of the most reported years for us, we saw $58 million in purchases within the city of Portland by companies in the Enterprise Zone program. So the effect is pretty strong, not just in their investment, but also in other businesses around the city. Since 2011, we have seen a significant increase in projects coming in. 26 new projects have brought in more than $450 million of investment, 1,400 jobs. These include companies such as Vigor. They're bringing the largest dry dock into North America here in 2014. Daimler Trucks North America is siting their new headquarter facility. Leatherman Tools is doing a $20 million expansion. It's been a really good couple of years for us. In East Portland, we have also seen incredible movement as well. Just in a year and a half,
We've seen six companies enroll: Leatherman, Bridgetown Natural Foods, New Seasons, Coaxis, Cascade Energy, and Triad Machinery. Those are contributing $78 million in new investment with over 300 jobs to East Portland. And so that's a really powerful, again, tool right away. We're seeing significant movement as a result of the program being in place for a very short period of time. Some context: back during the recession, we had zero enrollments for 2 years. So we've seen a pretty significant uptick since then. So thank you for that action last year today. It's helped us. So to the request, we're asking to include 48 acres of the Colwood Golf Course and 100 acres of the Port of Portland's Terminal 5 to the Portland E-Zone to stay within the statutory requirements of 12 square miles of any E-Zone. We also have to remove some portion of undevelopable land in Rivergate. This is wetlands and rail yards. And so that's part of the action as well, so that we stay within that requirement. To the first piece,
That area in yellow, the whole E-Zone?
Correct. That's the Portland E-Zone, and the East Portland E-Zone is a whole other map, which I can provide for you if you'd like it. So in terms of the Colwood Golf Course, it was recently rezoned as you participated in that process. We believe that bringing Colwood in is consistent with the Portland Comprehensive Plan, as well as our advanced manufacturing strategy within the City of Portland as we seek to have more industrial land available for investment.
And this is just that northerly 48 acres that's
correct.
Slated for development. The southern part that's going to be green space is not included.
Not included, correct. So Josh is going to speak to the Portland Bulk Terminal portion of it.
Yes. Mayor Hales and members of the council, thank you for your time. I'm here representing the Port of Portland, and we support the proposed enterprise zone modification, which we believe will help provide incentive to spur private investment and development activity at an existing potash export facility at the Port of Portland's Terminal 5 in Rivergate. You may not have seen potash before, so I brought a little sample with me here, and it resembles pink rock salt. Potash, or potassium salt, helps increase crop yields worldwide as a mineral nutrient used in the production of fertilizer. It's mined 3,000 feet underground from naturally occurring deposits in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, and Canada, where there's estimated reserves of 10 billion tons, which comprises about 60% of the potash reserves worldwide. CanPotex, which stands for Canadian Potash Exporters, is a joint venture among three of the major Saskatchewan potash producers. This marketing and logistics consortium transports potash from its mine sites by long unit trains of 100 cars or longer to its 100-acre Portland Bulk Terminal facility, their leasehold in Rivergate, and also to another terminal in Vancouver, British Columbia. It's been there in Portland since 1997. Portland Bulk Terminal exports more than 2 million tons of this potash annually to international markets, including Australia, Brazil, China, India, Indonesia, Japan, Korea, and Malaysia. The Portland Terminal is already home to the largest wooden structure west of the Mississippi, and they're looking to grow. And that's at the heart of why the Port of Portland supports this enterprise zone boundary change. The enterprise zone will encourage industrial development and capacity expanding investments at Terminal 5. A project under discussion by CanPotex currently is a minimum investment of $25 million and maybe as much as $150 million in new construction and capacity expansion here locally. Decisions on the scope of their expansion will be made early next year. If this project proceeds, it would represent an increase in tax revenue to the city of over $10 million over the first 10 years following construction, and that's even with a five-year tax abatement as allowed under the enterprise zone. Bulk cargo activities, including grain and potash at Terminal 5, provide an estimated 500 permanent high-paying transportation jobs throughout the metropolitan region and also throughout the state of Oregon. These jobs include river and bar pilots, tug and barge operators, railroad industry, as well as terminal management, security, and terminal operations jobs. The proposed expansion at Portland Bulk Terminal would increase cargo handling capabilities by 3 to 4 million tons, and through our economic impact modeling, we estimate that for every 1 million tons of potash handled, that equates to approximately 30 direct, indirect, and induced jobs that are created. We'd also anticipate positive employment impacts during construction. Lastly, it makes sense to remove 100 acres of undevelopable areas in Rivergate from the North Portland Enterprise Zone boundary and replace it with 100 acres at Terminal 5 that are not yet fully developed. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Mr. Reed, and I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have following.
I have one question about Colwood. The last time we took up an E-zone application, we had a fixed zoning designation on the underlying property. In Colwood, council recently took action to approve a change from open space to industrial for a portion of the property, which is in the process of working its way through the system. And I guess my question is, while the E-zone gives you a tax abatement on the improvements, is there any impact on property taxes we collect through the change in the zoning?
The existing land, well, you will see a positive effect potentially of turning it to industrial use, I'm assuming, as a new code allows for a different investment. So the existing land would still be taxed.
At whatever the appropriate level is.
We're
just talking about the improvements.
Just the improvements that would receive the abatement.
My question is, suppose we would make this investment regardless of whether we put them into an E-zone. How much property tax revenue are we forgoing based on that assumption?
So on a $1 million investment, you will see $100,000 of tax savings for a company and abatement. On a $100 million investment, you'll see a $10 million tax abatement. So you're forgoing on $100 million, $10 million over 5 years. That said, within 5 years, you're starting to kick off income, and you'll see it for the next 20, 30 years, depending on depreciation schedules. But to your question, yes, there is no E-zone, and so they have some financial decisions to make. Is this where they would like to site their next big investment?
What other options might they have?
I'm not certain. They haven't disclosed to me. I don't know if Josh has.
In our case, Canpotex has operations at Vancouver, British Columbia. They've also talked about a new facility at Prince Rupert, further north. And there are other bulk terminals and bulk ports that would be capable of handling it if they decided to do like Port of Vancouver is doing with BHP Billiton, which is to establish an entirely new facility.
And do those locations offer comparable tax abatements?
I don't have information on that, but I know it's a competitive marketplace.
Could you go over some more about the responsibilities in exchange for the tax abatement in terms of community benefits and family wage jobs, et cetera?
Yeah, so in addition to the 10% increased employment, they also have to pay 15% of their tax abatement to PDC, which then we turn around and use for investment in workforce training through Work Systems, Inc., and small business development. We use it for loans, for neighborhood economic development work. We're using some of the E-zone funds currently for our new NPI areas to help that process. They have to increase their employment by 10%. They have to pay their fees. They have to maintain their employment. They have to retain their employees, local procurement as well. They have to do first source hiring agreements to make sure that their jobs are posted through the employment department. So that's the kind of thing that they're responsible to do.
They have to pay into TriMet and to the police and fire too, right?
In the in this case, if Canpotex does do this investment, they would be required to provide subsidized bus passes for all employees if they earn more than $2 million in a tax abatement.
But they still pay their TriMet tax, was your question.
Right.
There's an additional.
Right. In addition to that, no matter what, they pay their TriMet tax because that's a payroll tax, right?
This is one of my favorite tax abatements because there is an additional list of responsibilities of the company that gets it. It's not just you get it and hope things go well. There's a reporting requirement. There's the family wage jobs. There's the union issues. There's the recognition that there is a cost to the jurisdictions, so that payment both to PDC and to some of the other jurisdictions. I can't see a downside to this, and I've been a fan of it since long before I was on the council. I think my blog is currently down, amandafritz.com, but went back in 2007. I wrote a pretty long article about, because I was all skeptical and ready to tear this down and say it was the worst thing ever, and I think it's one of the best things that we do.
Can I follow up on that for a second, though? Because there's a different impact of a tax abatement when it falls within an urban renewal district or outside of an urban renewal district. So could you walk us through that a little bit?
In what sense? Could you clarify a little bit more?
Well, for example, we went through this big look process with the county on tax abatements for housing. and they were concerned about foregone revenue. Well, when you apply a tax abatement within an urban renewal district where you're already diverting, you're taking the increment and sending it to PDC, they were ultimately persuaded that you didn't need a cap on the amount of abatements within an urban renewal district because it was coming out of PDC's pocket more than their pocket. And that, I guess, would be different if this E-zone is applied to an area that isn't covered by an urban renewal district, where the increment isn't coming to PDC, but is being, the growth is otherwise shared by the other jurisdictions. So,
correct. And in the case of Campotex in this investment, we have full backing of Multnomah County with this particular project. And in the past 5 years, as I've been running this program, we've had nothing but good things coming from them. They see the benefit as well. They have a special assessment team that I work with directly weekly, I'd say. And so they're aware of how much foregone revenue is coming out of their pockets.
That's good. So having Multnomah County's consent means they've looked at the foregone revenue piece, and presumably they have to agree to do something to take this off the tax rolls. So you need more than their consent. You have to have their assessor has to agree with them.
By statute, I don't believe we need to have Multnomah County's consent to run an enterprise zone.
But in practice, we get their consent.
But in practice, we always ask.
But, you know, we took up the issue of an enterprise zone in South Waterfront. Now, that's an urban renewal district where by giving someone a break on new capital expenditures, the money is mostly coming out of PDC's pocket, not out of the other jurisdictions, because you've already capped the property taxes and you have an urban renewal. So, but our enterprise zone boundaries extend beyond urban renewal districts.
I'd say, this is a guess, 50% of our businesses are not in a urban renewal area.
So just a point, I mean, because I think there's a different economic impact to this, to the jurisdictions, if it's whether it's within or without an urban renewal district.
Good points. Other questions for the team? Thank you both. Appreciate it. Anybody signed up to testify on this item?
No one signed up.
And it is
resolution.
So roll call and resolution, please.
Novick.
These things always make me queasy, because there's no way of knowing if the company was going to make this investment if we didn't put them in an E-zone. I'm going to say this with some reluctance and to a great extent out of deference to Commissioner Fritz, saying this is one of her favorite tax abatements. So I queasily vote aye.
Fritz. Thank you, Commissioner. This is the one where we get stuff, and we're sure we get stuff. We require the annual reporting. We get the community benefits, which otherwise we would have to pay for sometimes. We get the living wage jobs. We get things that not all companies are known for providing out of the goodness of their hearts. So I enthusiastically vote aye.
Fish.
Well, if I could also add that this is a tool that cannot be used unless we consent and approve it. And so where you come to us with an opportunity and you advise us that an employer is looking at other jurisdictions, and that seems to me to create an immediate urgent problem. Whether they're looking at other jurisdictions that have comparable benefits packages or not, we're still competing. And this is a tool authorized by the legislature that we can use to welcome an employer that's otherwise willing to make a substantial investment. And to Steve's point, whether we capture for 5 years the property taxes or not, there's other myriad other benefits to our local economy, not the least of which is the expansion in payroll. But think of all the construction jobs that are going to go into building a plant and other equipment, as well as other services. So there are tangible benefits beyond just the jobs. And I'm going to vote aye, because this can only be authorized following a hearing like this and used in a targeted way. Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Hales?
Well, thanks for your good work on a successful program for the city, for the port, for a lot of people. I had the opportunity just recently to visit one of the firms that you mentioned, which was Bridgetown Natural Foods. And I'll tell you, it was pretty impressive. Not only that this business had been started from scratch, bad pun, and grown fairly quickly here in Portland, they'd added, I think, 150 jobs in the last year. 70% of their workforce live in southeast Portland near the Lentz urban renewal area where it's located. They just invested about $10 million in a new production line, equipment, which unfortunately had to be imported from Germany, because I'm not sure if anybody makes this stuff here. but very sophisticated automated equipment that was baking and slicing granola bars at a furious rate. And the biggest problem they have as a manager of their workforce is translation, because they've hired so many new immigrants with so many different languages that it's a management problem on the plant floor to just get everybody working together and communicating. But they don't mind having the problem, and they're dealing with it, and it's a great problem to have, because it obviously demonstrates that they're hiring a lot of folks that are new Portlanders in many cases, and who aren't being prevented from employment by maybe limited English skills. So they're a great example of the community benefits that we do ask for, document, and get in this program. So thanks very much. Very pleased to vote aye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, 1207.
Amend various sections of the Public Works Improvement Code for consistency and clarity of general language and organization cleanup.
And we have a proposed amendment, I think. Is that right? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Council. My name is Dawn Hottenroth, and I'm the code writer for Environmental Services. And last week we had this item on the agenda, and Commissioner Fritz had a variety of questions for us that we took the item. Commissioner Fish took the item off the agenda so that we could resolve Commissioner Fritz's questions, which I believe we have done. And I have the amended language for you if you'd like to see it with Carla. So at this point, this is the first reading, just trying to get the cleanup done.
Let me turn to my colleague and friend. I got an email. Are you satisfied that your questions and concerns have been addressed?
Yes, the amendments do address my concern. Thank you.
Okay.
So we have the amendment before us?
I think we do, yeah. Yes. So do we need to move the amendment?
And this amendment has been reviewed and approved by BES?
The amendment language has been reviewed and approved by the City Attorney's Office, the Auditor, and BES staff.
Better.
Trifecta. All right. Further discussion? Motion on the amendment?
Second.
I can move it.
Further discussion?
Sorry, who moved the
amendment? I move it. You, Commissioner Fish.
Mm-hmm. Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Thank you very much for your responsiveness. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye. And this is a continuation of a previous item, so does anyone want to testify on this? If not, then it moves on to second reading. Thank you. Now, time certain, 1209.
1209, authorized City Auditor, Independent Police Review Division, to directly question Portland Police Bureau employees, change Police Review Board public reporting requirements, and other police accountability reforms.
Our auditor get us properly prepared here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good afternoon, LaVon Griffin-Vallade, Portland City Auditor. Thanks for everybody's patience today. It's a long day. Nice to be here with you, council members. Here with me is Constantine Sevier, Director of the Independent Police Review Division in my office. So this is the first reading of our modified proposal, which was first brought before you on October 23rd. I plan to bring it back on to council for a second reading and vote on January 2nd, the first date you are all back in session. So in early November, we were approached by the City Attorney's Office and a member of council and encouraged to move forward with changes to the IPR ordinance and other police oversight changes as expeditiously as possible. We all agreed that there was a need to modify some of the language in the October 23rd proposal to address concerns that had been raised, and we set out to work on that effort. Constantine will, in a moment, walk you through the more significant changes in the current proposal. These modifications were completed in close consultation with the City Attorney's Office over the last month or more. Ellen Osnak and Mark Amberg from the Attorney's Office is here and available to answer any questions you might have as we go along. So by way of some history, we briefed the mayor, his exec, and police bureau liaison on November 18th regarding the conceptual amendments to our previous proposal. city attorneys were also in attendance at that briefing. It was a very positive meeting, and we were encouraged to move forward. And let's see. In addition, other council members and or their staff liaison were subsequently briefed on those conceptual amendments, as was Chief Reese and his command staff. As a result, we continue to tweak the language. So we have had multiple conversations throughout this last 6 weeks with council liaisons and other stakeholders and shared the draft that closely mirrors the final version in early December. At the end of the day, the changes to the language are minimally different than the amendments presented to you on October 23rd. And we believe, and the city attorney's office concurs, that the version before you today addresses previous concerns and allows us to move forward with strengthening police oversight and accountability. So Constantine will take it from here.
All right. Thank you, Auditor. Mayor and commissioners, it's my pleasure as IPR director to present these proposed code changes to you and the community. Since the October 23rd council session, we have met with members of the public and been on local media discussing these code change proposals. Additionally, our office has briefed every council member staff on the progress of the code changes. Mr. Mayor, in particular, I appreciate you making yourself available on several occasions for us to provide a briefing to you. Commissioners Fish, Fritz, Novick, and Saltzman, I appreciate making your liaisons and yourselves available for myself and the city attorneys to provide briefings to you when you folks were available. Without the help of two particular city attorneys, we would not be here today. Alan Osinak and Mark Amberg have been invaluable in making sure that not only we have a good set of code changes, but also something that will be able to withstand legal scrutiny, which is important, not just that we do something that looks good, but that something is good. And that's what I believe we have in front of you today. These revisions to chapters 320 and 321 of the city code are the result of close to 1 year of work started by my predecessor, Mary Beth Baptista, and led by the auditor. That started soon after the settlement agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice was agreed to by council in November 2012. These code changes are premised on the proposition that for oversight to be effective, it must be objective, fair, consistent, and transparent. As you know, IPR is a bit of a hybrid agency. We are part of the auditor's office, and we are tasked by city code to hear community member complaints and commendations about Portland Police Bureau officers. We conduct initial investigations of all community member complaints and authorized to conduct independent full investigations. In officer-involved shootings and custody deaths, we serve as monitors, reporting to the scene, and following the investigation till its completion. The mayor brought up a ramming that occurred earlier today. Rachel Mortimer on our staff is actually at the scene right now, acting as a monitor reviewing the Police Bureau investigation of that, since that is treated as a deadly force incident. We must approve every investigation conducted by the Portland Police Bureau's Internal Affairs and approve recommended findings of an involved officer's commanding officer. Additionally, we are voting members of the Police Review Board, which hears cases where officers are facing possible discipline of a day or more, and also certain use of force cases, including officer-involved shootings and custody death. The CRC serves as our 9-member advisory board and hears appeals of community member or officers who wish to appeal recommended findings. The CRC is able to make recommendations directly to the Chief of Police and the auditor. In preparing to put this legislative code changes together, we have talked to various individuals and members of the community. These code changes don't appear in a vacuum. There has been a lot of work done in this community over the last 15 years in trying to figure out what does our city want our oversight system to look like. In putting together these code changes, we have relied on a lot of the work product as a result of these work groups, audits, including Mayor Katz's work group that she put together back 2000 that led to the creation of IPR. The Luna Fireball audit of IPR, which occurred in 2007. IPR's 2010 code changes that created the Police Review Board and the public report process and provide IPR with the ability to initiate independent investigations basically based on its own motion. Also, after the IPR code changes, there was a stakeholder report, which I've also used as a basis for some of the code changes that we have. Additionally, the auditor's office had a audit not that long ago. The Police Bureau is a learning organization. And finally, the Department of Justice settlement agreement. I think the DOJ settlement agreement is a key milestone in the evolution of our oversight system. In particular, it addresses the need for the city to implement a discipline guide, that administrative investigations are done in a timely manner, and that IPR have the ability to conduct meaningful, independent investigations. These were concerns that observers of our system within the city and outside the system, outside the city, had prior to the DOJ investigation, but as a result of the settlement agreement, there has been significant momentum in addressing these longstanding issues. Thanks to your support as council members, IPR has been able to hire 3 full-time investigators who have extensive backgrounds interacting with individuals with experiencing mental health issues. Additionally, we have been able to add a office support person who is tasked with being IPR's liaison to the CRC. The current code changes cover 3 areas. Changing IPR's internal procedures in administrative investigations, changes to the CRC, and changes to the Police Review Board disciplinary process. There is a relatively long presentation that I provided to you at the October 23rd meeting, so I'm not going to go in very detailed presentation to you, but I will go over what the changes are in total. Most importantly is the ability for IPR to directly interview all PPB employees, the ability for IPR to have jurisdiction over civilian supervisors of sworn PPB employees, that IPR must receive notification from the Portland Police Bureau prior to the termination of any misconduct investigation, and that all investigations of excessive force will be subject to full and complete investigations unless IPR has clear and convincing evidence that the dismissal is warranted. Additionally, when an administrative investigation exceeds 180 days, the police commissioner will be provided an explanation for the delay in the completion of that investigation. The changes to the CRC are two. One, increasing the CRC to 11 members, and that the CRC will serve, a CRC members individually serve as a rotating pool to serve on police review board cases in use of force cases. The changes to the police review board and the disciplinary process, one, which is a requirement of the Department of Justice settlement agreement, is that the city will implement a discipline guide as a tool for PPB managers and the police review board. That there will be a standardized format for the PRB public reports that are issued twice a year, and in officer-involved shootings and custody deaths, that the PRB public reports include officer witness names when the city has previously released those names, or if that disclosure is in the public interest. Finally, when the chief imposes discipline on an officer, the chief will, that is outside the recommended range in the discipline guideline, the chief will provide a written explanation in the final discipline letter stating his rationale for that. These current sets of code changes are critical to IPR and its functioning. There are several sets of changes that are in the DOJ agreement that we're not moving forward on right now, particularly those that involve the CRC, particularly the 21-day requirement that CRC completes appeals in that time frame. Currently, best case scenario for the CRC to be able to do an appeal, it's 60 days. There is a case file review, and then there's the actual appeal. In practice, that on average, that has led to CRC appeals being over 100 days. Given that the DOJ settlement agreement gives us 180 days to have cases done from when either IPR or the city receives notice of the complaint to when the chief has his proposed findings, having 100 days as a appeal period, I don't think is an acceptable proposition for the city at this point. That said, I think there are a lot of ways for us to economize and streamline our appeal process. That is a conversation that we need to have with the CRC and the wider community, and I feel given that the Department of Justice settlement agreement is not actually implemented yet, for us to wait on that and have those conversations, and when the DOJ agreement is implemented, that we come in front of council again and move forward on making those changes that need to happen for us to be in compliance with the DOJ agreement. This is the first reading on this proposal, and we plan to return to council on January 2nd for a second reading. In order for IPR to be an effective oversight agency, it is important that we have the tools to serve members of the public. In particular, the ability for IPR to directly interview PPB officers is critical. Currently, IPR dismisses about 70% of the cases that we receive. So in that 70% part of the cases that we receive about 400 complaints a year. So about 300 complaints, the total investigation that members of the public receive is the IPR portion. So for us to do our due diligence, in cases where we need to talk to the officers, we have to have the ability to actually do so in a way that is in compliance with the United States Constitution and is also in compliance with the collective bargaining agreement. I believe what's in the document in front of you and in front of the community allows us to do that. In the October 23rd proposal, there's a recommendation that IPR be able to compel officers and provide admonishment to them for interviews. Based on a memo that the city attorney's office provided to all of us, I believe in middle of November, we have changed our proposal so that a Portland Police Bureau liaison would provide the compelling of the officer and providing the admonishment. And the reason why that change was made for a admonishment, which is a constitutional warning, for that to be valid, it has to be done by somebody who is in the chain of command of that person receiving the notice. The police bureau is led by the police commissioner, the mayor. IPR is not in the discipline business. We are fact gatherers. We are either investigators or monitors of investigations, but we do not discipline officers. So for us to receive, for us to give valid, or for the city to give a valid notice to the officers, it has to be somebody in that chain of command. And that would be somebody that the Portland Police Commissioner delegates with that responsibility. Usually that's internal affairs. The other change is when the chief of police is outside of the discipline guideline recommended range. Originally, that was if the chief of police disagreed with the police review board. Given that the discipline guideline will become the baseline for us having an objective, consistent discipline system, it makes sense that all the fact finders along the way, whether it's the officer's commander, whether it is the police review board, the chief of police, that all decision makers rely on that discipline guide as a tool to when they're making decisions, and particularly the chief of police, when his decisions go outside of the discipline guide, that he provide a rationale. When the police review board goes outside of the discipline guide, the expectation would be that they would provide an explanation for their rationale as well. In officer-involved shootings, in custody deaths, the change was made to make the city code provision in compliance with Oregon public records law, where normally in Oregon public records law there is a presumption that the public body will disclose information. That is the presumption. When it comes to disciplinary records of public employees, the presumption is actually opposite, that there's an exemption. So in the context of an officer-involved shooting, in custody death, we change it so that when the public agency, the city, has released that information about who the officers were or the witnesses in the context of an officer-involved shooting in custody death, then the city, when it is releasing that information in the public report 6 or 9 months after the incident, it can go ahead and do that to provide completeness and transparency to members of the public. To my knowledge, in my 5 years here at the city, whenever there's an officer-involved shooting, within a week or so, the city has released the names of the officers. So I think that's a way for us to meet our transparency goals as an organization, at the same time meeting the confidentiality requirements that the public records law puts on us. And for the timeliness of the investigation, we removed the 180 days as a hard and fast deadline that many members of the public felt that we were putting on. This is something in keeping with the Department of Justice settlement agreement, where we mirror that language, where after 180 days, the police commissioner, as the person in charge of the police bureau, will receive notification about why a particular case went over the 180 days and provides us with a baseline and a kind of a measurable to look at why are cases taking particularly long. Is it a type of case? IPR in 2011 completed a timeliness study. We are currently working on another one, and hopefully that will be ready in the first quarter of 2014. And I am ready for any questions, if you have any, or a public comment.
You said something in the under the consistency and discipline section that just triggered a question. So the chief is required to provide a rationale when the final discipline is outside the range of recommended by the discipline guide. Well, what happens in the instance where it goes from the chief's recommendation to the commissioner in charge's recommendation, to the commissioner in charge, and the commissioner in charge decides to either increase or decrease the discipline? How does this section interplay with the final decision maker?
Well, the final decision maker, given the way our system of government works, is the commissioner in charge for every bureau. And in this case, the police bureau commissioner is not covered by this particular set of changes. It's basically all the different fact finders leading up to that decision. So the officer's commander, the police review board, the chief of police, and ultimately to the commissioner in charge. And the commissioner in charge is available. Generally, in a final discipline letter, there is included a rationale of why the decision was made. And, you know, based on this mitigation information or this information in aggregation, this is why I am making my decision as the police commissioner.
But just to be clear, each of us has the right to impose a more significant discipline or less based on mitigating circumstances. But the purpose of this IPR code change is to focus on the command structure within the organization up to the chief. And what happens at the elected level is not covered by this.
That is correct.
Mr. Sapir, there's just one little sort of almost a punctuation item I wanted to ask you about.
Sure.
On 3.21.220, it says that if an employee refuses to attend an investigative interview after being notified to do so by IPR, or refuses to answer a question or questions asked by APR during an investigative interview, the police chief or police commissioner shall direct the employee to attend the interview and or to answer the question or questions asked. And I just, to me, saying and or seems a little ambiguous. Does that mean that the chief or commissioner can decide to only instruct them to attend but not to answer the questions?
When you look at this as a total package, it envisions that the way it has worked in practice, a member is compelled by the police bureau representative, because we've recently done an independent investigation more or less using this format. So a police bureau member is compelled by the police bureau liaison. While they are there at the interview, they are given the admonition of, I am directing you in the name of the chief of police to answer these questions. So the compelling part and the admonition, they're separate parts of the process. So you don't do both during the interview. You only do the admonition. The compelling comes earlier.
Okay. I'm going to ask the city attorney, do you have any compunction, Ben, do you have any compunction about the and or phrasing, or do you think it's clear? No.
Thank you, Mayor Hales, members of the council, Harry Auerbach, acting city attorney. If I understand your question correctly, Commissioner, the situation can arise either because the officer doesn't come to the interview or he comes and he doesn't answer the question. And so you're concerned about if the ambiguity between his not doing one of those things and perhaps being ordered to do the other one. So it's a matter of interpretation when the council's intent. You could clarify it, I suppose, by taking out the slash or and just have him say he could be ordered to attend and answer the questions.
That's what I was wondering.
I mean, I suppose that would probably convey the same meaning.
I don't have a problem with that. Mark, you wrote that.
Mark Amberg, deputy city attorney. No, I don't have any problem with that clarification.
Thank you.
Yeah, I guess I read it the other way around, but it would probably also be a rarity, and that is that there might be an opportunity where they would just answer the question by sending them a letter.
I mean, our understanding is you want them to do both things, show up and answer the question.
Yeah, you want it on the record, so you want them to be at the hearing and answer the question.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think it's
fine. Would we be causing problems with it for ourselves if we said and?
I don't believe so.
All right. I move that we get rid of the slash or.
Second.
Further discussion of that amendment. Good catch. Roll call on the amendment, and then we'll take testimony on the amended ordinance.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye. Okay. Are there other proposed amendments?
Yeah, I have some. Carla, would you mind handing them out for me so that we get them to the folks at the table?
Yeah, you might.
A couple of concerns. The first one is in 320.140 for the Police Review Board. This is the section H4 that talks about where the chief and police commissioner's final discipline is outside of the range recommended. I would like to add a final sentence stating the cumulative report of discipline imposed outside of the recommended range shall be included in the Portland Police Bureau's semi-annual report. They currently do semi-annual reports on discipline and outcomes. Clearly, we don't want to identify individual officers or cases, but I spoke with Chief Reese about this yesterday, and he thought that this was a reasonable amendment to provide the cumulative report so that the public knows how many instances have happened of discipline being posed outside of the recommended range.
Just a question. I'm going to support this. Harry, does cumulative report have any particular meaning, or is it just clear we're talking about sort of aggregate data for the year?
Well, I'll tell you what I think it means, and if that's not what you intend it to mean, then maybe we need to clarify.
Let the sponsor.
What it says to me is that between each period of reporting, so you say it's semi-annual, each 6 months, the report would include the total number of discipline, you know, the report of the incidents in which discipline outside the recommended range was imposed during that period. Is that what you intended?
That was what I meant.
Yeah.
Okay. Further discussion? Roll call on that amendment.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye. Okay. Another
Thank
amendment?
You. My second one is actually a series of three amendments, and it's on Section 321.120 of Handling Complaints in Section G8. And the current language says that the police commissioner shall be notified and provided with explanatory information in all cases when an administrative investigation exceeds 180 days. My three suggested amendments are to say the police commissioner and the city auditor shall be notified, because there's two components to how long a review takes. One is within the internal affairs division in the police bureau, but also the time spent within the independent police review section. So both the police commissioner and the city auditor are responsible for the length of time that an administrative investigation takes. The second part of this amendment, and we can take them as one or three or whatever, is to say that in all cases when an administrative investigation exceeds 129 days. And the reason for 129 is because then that allows 30 days for an appeal and 21 days for the Citizens Review Committee to finish their review. The Department of Justice set an agreement, in my understanding, says that it's 180 days for the whole thing, including the Citizens Review Committee. And so just saying that when the administrative investigation exceeds 180 days doesn't allow the time for the Citizen Review Committee. If I'm getting that wrong, Ellen, is that correct or not?
No, that's correct. Your encapsulation of the requirements of the DOJ agreement. Yes, that's correct statement.
So I think it's incumbent on us to tell the Police Internal Affairs and the Auditor's Independent Review Division, you've got to be done in 129 days in order to leave sufficient time for the Citizen Review Committee to even have a shot at their 21 days, never mind if it extends beyond that. And then the third part of this amendment is that the information on both the explanatory explanation pieces would be posted on the city's website. So the full amendment would, amended section would say, the police commissioner and the city auditor shall be notified and provided with explanatory information for all cases where an administrative investigation exceeds 129 days and the information posted on the city's website.
But can I ask a question of the sponsor?
I think I have a second. Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you.
So what happens under your amendment if 180 days later the investigation is still not complete? Are we saying that there's no requirement at that point for notification explanation?
That's a good point, Commissioner. So there could be another sentence that said if the CRC's review is not complete after 180 days, there shall be a further notice. Part of my reason to...
You could just stick with the original language and append this in front of it, couldn't you?
Yes, you could do that. You could
both in the section?
Yes.
Right.
You could stick with the original language and say that the IA and IPR needs to be done by 120 days.
Yeah,
yes,
I think your intent was to expand, not contract. Correct. The scope.
That's correct. And then the other piece, of the important piece, is that the information would be posted, because otherwise if there's a survivor or a complainant, they don't know why they're... The police commissioner and the auditor would know, but that the person who's most involved wouldn't necessarily know why the investigation was taking longer than 180 days. But yes, if you have a different framing of it, Commissioner Fish, I'd be happy to just take a friendly amendment. But since the gist of it is on the table at this point, perhaps we could take testimony.
Oh, yeah, let's approve it conceptually. It might be the case. We'll ask the attorney and the auditor's office to think about the construction of this, but it might be simplest enough to just add this language in front of the existing language so the 180-day trigger still applies, but now we've added a 129-day one in front of that.
I'd appreciate that.
Okay. So and that's the spirit of the amendment anyway.
And the information posted on the city's website, that's acceptable?
I think so. When the having just seen this, I'm wondering if I might have just a further opportunity to look at it without going too in-depth on the record. I have one concern about the disjunction between a requirement of 129-day notification being different than the DOJ settlement agreement. And even with an amendment that would also have us reporting on 180 days, I could see a potential conflict between those two that I'd like to be able to sort of think through and then maybe give feedback to you all.
And sure. Since we're not voting on this till the second, that gives us time to do that.
Yeah, if that'll work for you.
Do that, but I guess we'll wait for your good counsel, but I think we're still free to overperform here, right? We don't have to do just what the DOJ says. We can do better.
Yes, absolutely. It's the issue of being in conflict with it.
Yeah.
We can adopt this now, and if you send us a memo before the second reading, on whenever the second reading is, we can take appropriate action if necessary.
Yes, I think it would be my preference to have you all wait to adopt it, if that's all right with Commissioner Fritz, but yes, you can do it either way.
Well, we're not adopting today. We're just amending.
Just putting the language into the draft ordinance.
Taking it to a second reading.
And Mr. Walters, did you have a suggested language for us? Or
So I want to make sure that I'm capturing the intent. There would be two sentences in G8 as a result of the amendment. And the first sentence would read, the police commissioner and the city auditor shall be notified and provided with explanatory information in all cases where an administrative investigation exceeds 129 days and the information posted on the city's website. And the second would read, the police commissioner and the city auditor. So the second sentence would also be amended to conform. Shall be notified and provided with explanatory information in all cases where an administrative investigation exceeds 180 days and the information posted on the city's website. Is that the intent that there be two postings, two notifications, two postings?
The second, well, one of them is 129 and the other is
180. 180, right.
Yeah.
But with the second one, is there any, in both cases, putting it on the website just tells the public what's going on, right?
So. Yeah, it just tells the public what's going on. It lets the CRC know that there's a completed investigation, that there's a 30-day period when it might be appealed, and that they better get... At that point, actually, if they knew that, they could start looking at the record, presumably, before the 21 days so that they could then make their decision in the timely manner expected by the DOJ.
Unfortunately, that's not the way our process works. the CRC isn't able to proceed on an appeal until somebody files notice that they want to do an appeal. And before that, you know, there's a whole series of steps. IPR, you know, does their part of the investigation, goes to internal affairs, and then it goes to the officer's commander to do his part of the case for the findings, and then we receive notice. We give notice to the